Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. A difficult day to do a live radio show here in Charlottesville. August 12th here at Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. So we've decided to do something a bit different. We're going to play the voices of other people. We're going to do the voices of folks who tell in their memories from last year. And we're going to start by playing Professor Walt Heineke and Clara, a UVA professor and a recent graduate student who were at the Jefferson statue on August 11th. I began the conversation by asking them to tell me what happened that night.
We linked arms around the statue of Thomas Jefferson, and we began chanting. So we were chanting Black Lives Matter and no Nazis, no KKK, no fascist USA. And as we were chanting and continuing to chant, we heard the chants of the neo-Nazis on the other side of the rotunda. And then they began filling down the steps with their torches. We continued to stand there, to remain strong, to continue our chanting, as I'm sure you know, they said, you will not replace us, blood and soil. And then they violently attacked the counter-protesters, and Walt and other folks came in and told us to get out of it, that it was unsafe. I was fortunate. I was not badly hurt. I inhaled some of the chemical weapon that was sprayed into the crowd. But I was okay. I lost my friends for a moment, but we gathered and we were able to recuperate and know that we were all safe. At the moment that many protesters were being treated for chemical weapons spray in their eyes, the police declared it an unlawful assembly, and so it became even more unsafe for us to be there, and so we left. What we saw is, I've said this before, and I'll say it again, is that the university has blood on their hands. This is something that they have never really been held accountable for, students and community members were the ones that were there gathered to protect each other and to stand up against white supremacy and to say Nazis were not welcome here, and that's something that, the university over the past year has failed to do.
Walt, how do you, as someone who's employed by the university, Clara can graduate and move on and choose to return and choose what she does with her diploma to hide it or show it. But as someone who's employed by the university, I'm curious about your emotions on that Friday night, what you see and how you react and what you do this coming Saturday.
When I showed up at the rotunda right before 10 and saw those students, including Clara, surrounded by these torch-bearing neo-Nazis, threatening them and screaming these epithets at them, I saw no police presence. And I saw Alan Groves, and I told Alan, I asked him where the police were, and the violence level became so intense that we waded in to the students, but sort of threading between the neo-Nazis, and ask the students if they were safe and if they wanted to go home. But before we even, or to get out, and before we even got around the circle, you know, all hell broke loose and the violence on the part of the neo-Nazis started. And slightly, and once that happened, I tried to sort of pull students out to the west side of the rotunda to get them away from the neo-Nazis. And I immediately called 911 and asked for police presence because there was no police presence. So my feelings at that point were I was fearful for my life, but more importantly, I was afraid for a lot of the students that I've been teaching over the years and who I respect, you know, greatly, and who and the folks that had been doing the community members that I knew there that were doing anti-racist work were putting their bodies and their lives on the line, and I was fearful that someone was going to get hurt that night. So I have a lot of pride in the students and in the local community activists who have been continually showing up and putting their bodies on the line, and I want to support them going forward. You know, Joe Biden, our former vice president, commended those students for taking civic action, and to this day, I have heard nothing from the university doing the same. You know, they haven't acknowledged really the students' role in protecting Charlottesville, protecting and promoting democracy, fighting for anti-racism. They've not done that, and I've been extremely disappointed in the university's response to those brave students and community members who were there on the rotunda that night and who have been doing the really hard work ever since to defend Charlottesville from neo-Nazism, white nationalism, and racist. So I, going forward, I intend to support those students and the community members that have been doing such incredibly great work to defend Charlottesville and to promote, you know, anti-racism and justice in the United States.
That was Professor Walt Heineke and recent graduate Clara. This is Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. I'm host Rick Moore. We're looking back on Charlottesville, August 11th and 12th, 2017. Our next guest, Lisa Province, she's the Seville Weekly News Editor. And I started by asking Lisa for some of her memories on August 12th of last year. Lisa, with some interesting tales.
I was on the perimeter of Emancipation Park, and when you ask for memories of that, the whole thing has a surreal quality to it, and sometimes I feel like it plays back like a movie instead of something that I actually was there, but it was just so unreal that that's still sort of the way I think of it. Like, did that really happen?
What are your emotions that go with that, being someone who's lived in Charlottesville for so long?
I was there as a reporter, so in many ways, I think I was just in a different mode where, you know you've got a job to do, and you're focused on that. And so even as many awful things as were happening that day, it really was, it took me several days. It was later that week before I had a moment to, you know, sit down and cry and think about it, you know, and really, it really hit me more so later than it did initially, because it was just trying to cover it and then trying to get a story written. And so, that's how it affected me.
Did you step into August 12th differently, knowing what had happened on August 11th at UVA?
Perhaps. I think probably so, because seeing what happened on August 11th again was another surreal, horrifying scene. And that, I was not there. I was watching it being live streamed through Emily Gorsinski. And so just watching this march go through grounds, and then when she got to this little band of counter protesters at the Thomas Jefferson statue and knowing, I mean, it was just, it seemed like a few kids, and knowing this mass of torch-carrying white supremacists and people chanting Nazi slogans were approaching them, it was just, it was terrifying. And then Emily's live feed goes dead. So that was really, that was probably one of the most chilling things that I witnessed that weekend. Certainly the car incident on 4th Street, that was so horrifying, but I wasn't there at that time. I had gone over to McIntyre Park to see what the, you know, departing white supremacists were doing, and that's where Richard Spencer and David Duke and, well, they were sort of gathering up. And so I was there. My colleague Samantha Bars was here, and, you know, our building is in the same block that borders 4th Street, so she could hear that crash happen. And I'm sure would have, you know, a much different perspective on that.
Do you think it's possible for yourself to separate Lisa Province, a Charlottesville resident, from Lisa Province, a news reporter, to look back on this?
Yeah. I mean, I think we do that every day. But still, as a resident here, you know, it's just still hard to imagine, still horrifying to imagine that happened here.
And what
but it
you,
did.
And what are your plans for August 12th of this year?
They're still somewhat evolving, but I will be downtown at some point, and we will be trying to cover what I think everyone is hoping will be a non-event. That's the goal.
That was Lisa Province, news editor at the Seville Weekly. This is WPVC doing a show looking back on Charlottesville, August 11th and 12th of 2017, listening to the voices outside of the studio. Next up is Christine Rivera. Chris, a clergy at a local Unitarian Universalist church, opens by sharing the plans of the clergy last year.
I was part of a group of clergy that had been organizing for many weeks prior to August 12th. We knew that this rally, you know, the right rally was happening. And so in about the month and weeks prior, once we had seen what had happened in July with the KKK rally, we knew we needed to have a faithful presence in Charlottesville. So that took the form of the day of a group gathering at First Baptist Church on Main Street on Charlottesville for a morning worship service, in which those who were going to be frontline witness folks on the line in downtown Charlottesville were gathered together. We walked to Emancipation Park in anticipation of probably being stopped by police and being held back from even being able to be there. And we were surprised at the very evident lack of law enforcement there. Not so much from at least for me, not so much from a safety aspect, but just that wasn't the experience that many of us have had in other cities when there is going to be protests, and there's usually a very visible police presence, and that was not the case. So as we got closer to the park, I noticed that there was a line of what I thought was National Guardsmen basically surrounding the park. And I thought, oh, okay, well, they've decided to go a different route on this. And it wasn't until we got fairly close to these individuals that I realized that it was actually militia, self-appointed militia, that were guarding the park. And again, that there was just no law enforcement anywhere to be found, that they had basically ceded any authority that they had to these folks that were coming to announce their interpretation of white supremacy and their interpretation of free speech and their interpretation of what they found sacred about that space.
What were your emotions?
I was, my heart was beating really fast. One of the tactics that we have when we're doing witness and resistance protests is to, as we're standing in a line, to have folks, some folks spaced in one direction as we're linking arms and some folks spaced in another direction as we're linking arms. And when we went into that kind of formation, my role would have been to have my back towards these militia with these semi-automatic rifles who are basically about 2 feet away from me. And, you know, my father told me never to turn your back on somebody who has a gun and does not have your best interests at heart. And it was, you know, something where I had to make a decision as to, you know, how strongly I felt of the people that I was with the clergy that I was with. And that was hard, and it was scary, and it was, I hadn't expected it to be militia. I had expected it to be law enforcement.
What were you thinking about the law enforcement that you could see or wished you could see?
I was, you know, there were different folks who were talking about this at the time, and it was very quickly, I realized very quickly that they just had no interest in either nominally protecting the resistance protesters or even really having a presence in the area at all, that they felt like clearly their real lack of presence in the area was ceding that authority to this self-appointed militia folks that were there. And I thought that was a very interesting tactic of theirs, because while they couldn't be said to being protecting, you know, white supremacists, they also couldn't be said to be protecting folks who were there to provide faithful witness.
Did you see violence take place?
We saw quite a bit of violence take place throughout the day. As clergy, we were there to de-escalate in situations throughout the day. Many of my clergy colleagues were in the thick of violent escalation between protesters and the alt-right that was there. There were many instances where clergy were literally, you know, pulling people apart. I had clergy members who were injured, had, you know, blood on their stoles and robes, as they were really the only presence there that was seeking to try and call people to their better selves.
How has August 12th changed your thoughts and views of Charlottesville?
I think what I've seen is a Charlottesville that has awoken to what many people of color in Charlottesville already knew. So you have large groups in Charlottesville people of color who've always known that Charlottesville is steeped in white supremacy and racism. And you had a Charlottesville dominant culture that was just going about its everyday business, not paying attention to that and not paying attention to what Charlottesville has been built up around and whose shoulders it stands on. And I think that what I've seen is a Charlottesville that can no longer look away from that, that what August 12th did was really brought to the forefront for, frankly, white people in Charlottesville as to what is really here. Because I don't think that you could, for as much as you could say folks were coming in to Charlottesville for this rally, there were also folks from Charlottesville, a large number of folks from Charlottesville and surrounding areas that were already here and part of this rally. And I think that's one of the things that people just can no longer, have plausible deniability as to what the reality is in Charlottesville and what the reality has been for a very, very long time.
That's Chris Rivera, clergy at our local Unitarian Universalist church. We need to take a break. We are looking back on Charlottesville, August 11th and 12th of 2017. More voices from people who were there last year. Next up, we're going to hear from Aze Amos, a Charlottesville professional photographer, who's going to describe how his day started downtown at 5:30 a.m.
I marched to the church, the church on Main Street, where they had a service for all the clergymen and women that were going to be in the front line. So I was there photographing that for about an hour when they had the procession from there to Jefferson School. I followed them there also, and then they marched from there to McGaffey Park. And I also, marched with them. I have to say this, though. Marching with them to McGaffey Park, whilst I was photographing them walking into, all getting into the park, I turned around and I saw a gentleman standing behind me wearing a white T-shirt and a brown khaki, typing something on his phone. He looked really off because of his haircut. He had the style of his haircut. So I walked up close to him and I took a shot of him. The sound of my shutter made him look up, and I took a nice good shot of his face. And that gentleman turned out to be the driver of the car. So I got a really, really good shot of him that morning around 9 o'clock.
James Alex Fields Jr.,
yes, correct.
You were taking photographs. You were focused on taking photographs. Were you ever frightened? Were you ever scared?
Oh, yes. Funny story. Before that day, my wife had tried to discourage me from going. She just said I should just come up with a reason why I shouldn't go. Like, I should just stay home. I don't have to. But she was out of town, so I didn't have a choice. I was like, I'm home alone. Let me go do this. So I went out, and I kept telling myself, the cops are going to be there in an overwhelming number, and they'll protect everybody. That was what I kept telling myself, so I wasn't scared. Like, I'm a black man, but I'm sure the cops are going to be there to protect us. So I walked up from, I left McGaffey, I walked up to the park, Lee Park, where I saw all the men with their very heavy rifles, and that really scared me at first. I was like, what is going on here? So I walked up to some of them and tried to interview them and find out who they were, but none of them would speak with me or talk to me. So it was then I noticed the first group of alt-right guys walking towards the park, and they were led by Eli Mosley. I got a really good shot of him walking and leading the guys, and he looked really mean, like he was really mad at something else. And that gave me a hint of what was to come that day. Eli Mosley and his men, that was the first confrontation. They just started beating people, and this lady, they beat her up, and there's blood all over her face. And the cops just just watch it. And this was a white woman. It was at that point I got scared. I said to myself, a white woman just got beat up by these guys. They drew blood, and the cops did nothing. That was when I started suspecting something was wrong, and I got so, so scared. I'm like, oh, God, I'm in the wrong place. And that made me really very cautious. I started being very, very cautious of where I was standing, where I was going, and all of that. And that was how I went all day. So I made sure I wasn't alone at any point in time. But that didn't stop me from getting punched in the face. It was just those little things. And I saw people, you know, hitting themselves with sticks, pepper spray. And it was a point where I got pepper sprayed, and the cops asked me, what, they were like, what is that? They were behind the barricade, and they were like, what is that? I walked up to them and said, guys are pepper spraying everybody. They're hitting people with sticks. And the guy was like, oh, okay. And he just turned around doing his thing. I was so shocked, like, what is going on here? I still, you know, even up to now, I still don't get it. And that's why it's funny today. Right now, I'm sitting here in my car. I'm looking at Omni Hotel, and there are cops everywhere. There are cops out up of the parking lot. They're looking down at me. They're like, there are two of them right now. There are cops all over the place. And it's kind of like the same thing. They overreacted when the Klan came to town. They didn't do nothing. They didn't do anything when the alt-right guys came to town to let people get injured and all of that. And now they're overreacting again. They just can't get it right. I just feel I have to tell the story. I mean, who else is going to tell it? I know there are a lot of photographers coming from out of town, and they all have their agenda. They have their assignments. They have what they're coming here to, you know, what they're coming here to do, or what they're coming story they're coming to tell. I feel, you know, this is my town. This is where I live, and it kind of the responsibility. Kind of, I have the responsibility to tell the story, to try to tell the story of this town.
Thanks to Aze Amos, a professional photographer, telling this frightening story about his time downtown in Charlottesville last year. And we are talking about looking back on Charlottesville last year. Next up, Cynthia Neff, a local activist, and she begins by sharing her role for the day.
Well, on August 12th, I was a legal observer with the National Lawyers Guild. And, you know, we're charged with watching, merely watching, and trying to, you know, keep track to see if primarily our concern was for the counter-protesters. We knew a bunch of folks from BLM and Antifa and just poor people and interested people and activist people were going to show up, and we really wanted to make sure that as the protesters, that, you know, people that I either refer to mostly as Nazis or white supremacists showed up, that we would be able to, you know, make sure that how the police were reacting and taking care of them. And so I was at I met the clergy at up at the Baptist Church on West Main Street, and we had a briefing there with all of them, and then we marched down to Emancipation Park, where I stayed until, you know, it was declared an unlawful assembly. We get to Emancipation Park, and all of a sudden I can hear people shouting and yelling about Jews will not replace us, and you're seeing all of these, you know, relatively well-dressed, clean-cut white guys, but many of whom were had shields and weapons, and then, of course, the guys with all of their military paraphernalia. And I remember standing there, and I asked the guy, you know, this was like 7:38 in the morning, and it's like, you know, what are you? Are you, you know, who are you with? And he referred me to his, you know, commanding officer, who wouldn't talk to me either. And it was just bizarre. So, you know, the day just got started on this really bizarre note, watching all these people come in. But, you know, there was a lot of things that I ended up learning that morning early that gave me a clue that we were going to have a horrible day. I mean, at one point I remember looking at a guy standing next to me, and I went, oh my God, it's not even 9 o'clock yet. and I've lost my sense of humor, and this is really not going well. So the thing that we noticed right away was that the entrance to the park that the protesters, the people with the permit, the Nazis and white supremacists, were supposed to come in, that's not what they were using. Instead, they were coming in right on Market Street, across the street from the parking lot where all the police were gathered and stayed for the whole day. So here are all these people that are coming in, like they'd parked in the Market Street garage and were marching down the street right in the midst of all the people you would consider to be counter-protesters. And I went up to a police officer and I said it was my understanding that the Nazis and the white supremacists were supposed to be using the far entrance. But there was nobody directing them. There was nobody telling them they were going the wrong way. They were just all kind of marching in these small groups together, you know, chanting and shouting and making racial slurs and, you know, saying horrible things to the, because the clergy, you know, had their arms linked together in front of Emancipation Park on Market Street. And it was amazing to watch the slurs that they threw at the clergy, especially at the women, about, you know, accusing them all of being lesbians and how ugly they were and how fat they were. And it was just appalling. And they just kept coming. And the police said that, you know, that wasn't something they were doing, was directing them. And I said, but can't you see that we're mixing these people, or having to literally pass each other, almost touching each other? And I said, this isn't going to go well. And I saw a guy get slugged. And again, this was before 9 o'clock. I saw the guy. The guy then ran off, and he went inside the pen, you know, the fencing where the Nazis and white supremacists were. Oh, I'm so sorry. That's my dog. But they, you know, what happened then was the police, I asked the police if they would, you know, talk to this gentleman and make a police report, and they said no, because they had not witnessed it themselves. And I said to them, I said, well, but don't police, you know, follow a crime that they didn't witness themselves all the time? I mean, I'm making a report. I saw this man get slugged by that man standing over there. And the police just walked away. They wouldn't do anything. So the whole morning just kind of kept getting worse and worse as more people showed up. And multiple times I went up to police and asked them, are you going to do anything? Are you going to get involved? And the answer was, we're watching it. And as we all now know, looking back, they never did do anything. They merely stood there the whole time. So, you know, I guess the thing that was the most distressing about standing there right on the corner of Emancipation Park was in the midst of the people who were on both sides, and when they started throwing newspaper stands and stuff at each other, it was just this hopeless sense of chaos. How do we stop this? You know, how do you know in an event like this? It was hard to tell who was who. People were really getting hurt, and nobody helped. We kept using, calling for medics, and I mean, the shout, you could hear all up and down the street people shouting for medics. And of course, the only medics there were volunteers. You know, there weren't any of the medics from the emergency services, so it was really quite appalling that we were dependent, you know, on trying to, and then the tear gas and the pepper spray. Oh, my God, it was horrible. And, of course, you know, the ironic thing in Virginia is that you can't wear masks. If you wear a mask, you can be arrested. in a situation like that. And so, of course, that day nobody was being arrested for anything. So we started telling people, go ahead and try to, you know, put on masks and cover up your face. But it was just a mess.
How has August 12th changed your view of Charlottesville?
You know, I moved here 12 years ago. I really did. I mean, I knew that a lot of those Charlottesville is the best place to live, retire, eat, play, whatever, you know, was marketing. You know, I understood that. But it felt a little bit that way, and it looked a little bit that way. And then it's like August 12th happened, and you realize there's all this hate and ugliness in the world. And the interesting thing is that it also kind of tore like a fingernail that what ended up happening was that all of the issues around the racism that's been buried, you know, in affordable housing and all that rose to the surface. And we can't move past it because there's still so much work to be done.
This is Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Looking back on Charlottesville, August 11th and 12th, 2017, through the voice of others. And that was Cynthia Neff, a longtime local activist. Next up, we're going to listen to Lynn Windsor. She's a UVA grad and a longtime local resident. And we started our conversation with me asking about being downtown with her daughter on August 12th.
Well, my daughter and I often go down to the city market pretty much every week and just, you know, buy local and enjoy the whole vibe down there with the city market. But I'm also a member of Seaville Arts, and that's an art gallery on the downtown mall. It's a cooperative. But when we got down to the mall with all the state troopers down there, they were talking back and forth as, you know, things started to develop on the mall. And then the chatter back and forth was, well, there was fighting at the end of 2nd Street. Well, nobody realized that there were or at least the state troopers we were talking to didn't realize that there were 2 2nd Streets on the mall. And the unrest was at the east side, near the library. And the guys at West 2nd were looking down the street and trying to figure out what the heck was going on because they didn't see any fighting. And so my daughter and I basically explained to them the way the mall was situated and where the fighting was. There was military trucks and SWAT teams down near the city's part of the mall, and by the library where 2nd Street goes in there, people were pouring out all the way onto the downtown mall, and there were people with guns, people with flags, with swastikas. I mean, it was awful, and I've never felt unsafe on the downtown mall. But that day, it was awful. I think part of it was the helicopters going overhead. And that just was so loud and so unsettling. And with the police presence and everybody was just, I mean, everybody was on edge. And this is only 10 o'clock in the morning. They had expected the rally to start around noon, and by 10 o'clock they were already getting recounts of people fighting. And so I said, you know, hey, I don't feel good about this. This is not turning out. We can't do anything. We can't open the shop. So my daughter and I went back up to where we had parked the car. And that was in what's considered the metered lot and right off the back of the mall. And as we were going up the hill to the metered lot, there were actually groups of protesters with assault rifles and full combat gear walking past us, going towards Lee Park. And it was just the most unsettling, awful feeling that they had been invading, you know, what is usually just a great place to be. You know, local people, local vendors, you know, great produce, something I do every week. And that week, it wasn't our mall. It was really being invaded. So,
what was it like being a mother at that time?
Well, my daughter at the time had purple hair and was rainbow colored and just, you know, expressing herself as she normally does. And the looks from these guys with guns was just, it was really scary. They obviously did not agree with what was going on, you know, how or how she was expressing herself. And they didn't say anything directly to us at the time, but she later went down to Veterans Park and on her own time and was in the middle of it, and they were yelling at her and asking her about her colorful hair and, you know, making her, belittling her. And I mean, I just plain blank said, hey, look, you know, we best get out of here because it's not going well. And but on the other hand, I was really mad. I mean, this is, they're bringing hate into our space. So, you know, the rebel in me wanted to stay down there and, you know, tell them that they couldn't invade like that. But the mother in me was, hey, you know, time to get out of here. These guys are up to no good. So,
what are your plans for this this August 12th?
Go hang out on the mall.
This is Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We're looking back on Charlottesville, August 11th and 12th. That was Lynn Windsor talking about her adventures with her daughter last year. Let's take another break. This year, the difficulty of doing a show on August 12th, the decision was made to let others tell their stories. So we're going to continue that for the hour. Our next voice is going to come from John Herman. John is a longtime resident, also a UVA grad, but a former UVA employee as well. John talks about his day downtown on August 12th.
At one point, Allison and I went back towards the mall, and we got in a funny situation where there was a long line of state troopers in riot gear marching behind us, and we were heading towards a group of white supremacists in, who were kind of marching in formation and had sort of makeshift handmade weapons of various kinds. And we were walking down one of the side streets on the downtown mall, and with the cops marching behind us and marching towards these other guys marching towards us, and we're kind of caught in the middle here, and we kind of sort of stepped aside against the wall, brick walls of one of the buildings, to let them pass. And the two lines, you know, of police and neo-Nazis just kind of marched past each other. It was just all very odd that the police were doing this thing where they, you know, they had a group of 25 or so heavily armed officers who would assemble in a location, and they would march to another place and then stand around there for a few minutes, and then they would head off and march with purpose but to another place. But it all seemed very random. It didn't have any deeper purpose, but it was just, I guess, what they consider establishing a presence or making their presence known.
Were you frightened during the day?
At times, I would say at times we were frightened. I mean, we were on a high level of adrenaline. That one time where we were kind of caught in this really peculiar position where we were between these two lines, and we weren't sure what was going to happen. Were the police going to go disarm them? Were they going to, you know, was there going to be a sort of battle, or was it, you know, or not? And it turned out it wasn't. It was all just kind of guys playing at war or something. It was, I don't think either the police or these guys really had a clear intention of what they were doing. They were mainly just trying to intimidate with their, you know, militaristic poses. And, you know, my sense of it was that while the white supremacists were, well, were somewhat organized and certainly were in groups, and they had uniforms of a sort and, you know, were coordinating their efforts, they were vastly outnumbered by the counter-protesters. And at that point, you know, the event had, their little party in the park had been disrupted. They hadn't been able to have their hate speeches, and they were all pretty mad. And, you know, some of them were clearly just trying to get away. But they, you know, they their plans had been foiled, and they didn't really know what to do. And they were definitely frustrated. And, they, you know, the crowd was giving them a lot of grief, taunting them. And I would say, you know, we reached a point where it just seemed like the counter-protesters had sort of won the day. And we got word about the incident with the car. And, yeah, as we later learned, to Heather Heyer being killed and a number of other people being injured, including somebody who was a longtime friend and former neighbor of mine, you know, who still suffers pretty serious PTSD and other post-traumatic disorders as a result of that horrible incident. But, you know, that obviously cast a great pall, and, you know, we're actually feeling sort of celebratory. We're looking at pictures of Richard Spencer being arrested and having his face mushed in the grass, and feeling like, you know, sort of the good guys won. And then we got the, you know, the news that, you know, this, things had taken a terrible turn. And we had just passed by that area where the car incident occurred, you know, probably 10, 15 minutes earlier. So we walked down that street off, and Allison worked right around the corner from there. And so, you know, that was a place we knew well, and like I said, had just been. So it sort of shook us up, certainly, to know that happened, and that we easily could have been there and had just missed it. And certainly the people that we knew and cared about were involved in that. So, so, you know, that
where are you going to be? Where are you going to be this August 12th?
So I really don't know. My partner did go out of town for the weekend. She's gone to her parents' house. She just didn't really want to be here. The memories and associations of last year, really too painful to want to experience again. But I don't know. I guess I would like to do something to show solidarity to the people who stood up against this hatefulness last year, but I don't know what a meaningful thing to do would be. So, so I don't know. I think I'll probably just sort of monitor what's going on social media, and I'll probably spend some time in the downtown mall, if nothing else.
It was John Herman, a longtime resident of Charlottesville, talking about his day downtown last August 12th. This is Looking Back on Charlottesville last year, 2017, August 11th and 12th. Next up, we're going to hear the voice of Dave Norris, a former Charlottesville mayor, describing his day in and around downtown.
Well, I was horrified. I mean, it was just I realized after that day what a pretty sheltered life I've lived, or I had lived, because I saw more violence in one day than I'd ever seen it. throughout my life. Sad to see our town get swallowed up in that orgy of violence, and sad to see just this toxic brew of white supremacy and anti-Semitism and toxic masculinity and white nationalism just sort of invading our town, and all of the ugliness and violence that it spawned. It was pretty overwhelming day, and I hope we never repeat it.
As someone who's had to work on city council, mm-hmm. someone with a religious background, someone who's helped those with on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, how do you put any of those together or look at any of those on a singular thought process for that day?
Well, I think there's a direct connection between the, again, sort of the white supremacy that was being championed and celebrated that day and the work that many of us have been doing to advance the cause of justice in Charlottesville going back many years. And obviously, while that event was sort of a one-off event, and again, hopefully will never be repeated, but a lot of the underlying themes of white supremacy sort of race war sort of rhetoric, and it's sort of, people have had to deal with this going back centuries in Charlottesville, going back to the days of slavery and going through the days of Jim Crow and the days of massive resistance. And I could go on. And even in recent years, just challenges around the criminal justice system and the education system, access to quality housing and gentrification, and I could go on. So there are direct connections, although it had never been rendered so visible and so ugly and so violently as it was on the weekend of August 11th and August 12th. I think that was, in some ways, hopefully, a high watermark for their movement. And in the year since, they've really lost a lot of their steam, and they've turned on themselves. And they've shown themselves to be not a force that is capable of making meaningful change in the country, but rather a group of malcontents that really deserve universal and have earned universal condemnation. So I don't really expect a big turnout of alt-right or white supremacist forces this weekend. I'm hopeful that means it'll be a relatively quiet weekend and we can move on with the much more important work of advancing the cause of justice in Charlottesville.
That was Dave Norris, former Charlottesville mayor. This is 94.7 WPVC, Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, as we listen to many progressive voices who were looking back on Charlottesville, August 11th and 12th. I'm Rick Moore, the host of Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We have another voice to hear, Clara, who was one of the voices that started our show. She's a recent UVA grad who was out at the Jefferson statue last August 11th. Going to tell us what her plans were that have now become history, most of which the school seemed to have stopped ahead of time. Claire, what is your plan for this weekend now that it's August 11th and August 12th return?
So this weekend, our group is planning an event, the Rally for Justice VA Students Act Against White Supremacy, which will be this Saturday at 7 p.m. So what we're trying to do and why, you know, I want to be there again in a space that was very traumatic for me is that, you know, I want to reclaim that space, you know, continue to say that we as students are on the front lines against fascism. You know, we are fighting white supremacy so many of its forms, right? Whether it's overt white supremacy that takes place in the form of 300 Nazis marching on your campus, or whether it's white supremacy that is in the form of, you know, workers at the university not earning a living wage. So this Saturday, we will be there, hundreds of students and community members and activists and professors are going to show up and stand with us in solidarity. So I think it's going to be really strong and really empowering. And, you know, we're also going to be continuing to demand that this university take action. One of the things that we have been demanding over the past year is that the university pay the medical bills for the survivors of August 12th. Many are still struggling to pay those bills or to make up for lost wages. And so, you know, we believe that the university can afford to support them. It has done events like the Concert for Charlottesville, where it raised many funds that were supposed to go to survivors, but there's been no transparency about how much was raised, where those funds have gone. So students are continuing to show up and say, you know, our university is in many ways accountable, and we envision a very different place in which survivors are centered, and that we can move forward and say Nazis are not welcome here, right? We can say that by banning them from our grounds, by issuing no trespassing orders, and, you know, actually being accountable to the larger Charlottesville community and showing up in a way that the community needs and wants to see. So that's a little bit about Saturday and why we'll be out there again.
Obviously, the university had different plans. This has been the Sunday morning wake-up call, looking back on Charlottesville, August 11th and 12th of 2017. I want to thank everyone who took the time to relive those memories and tell those stories, an important part of history. I want to thank Dan Gould, who this show wouldn't have happened without his production and technical help. You can find the show on Seville Podcasts. You can tell your friends it's an important thing that has happened today. I've had a difficult time putting this together because of the memories and images that go with that. I hope you enjoyed the hour. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SevillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.